Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Democrat Dan Johnson Weinberger, Republican Chris Voronis, and special guest economist Robert Janetsky. Our program tonight coming to you from our home at the Sirius XM Studios on Chicago's Great West Side, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. I'm sure you all know by now that in the world of politics, the United States Senate allegedly has reached an agreement with at least three Republican members of the Senate and have come up with their package, an $827 billion economic stimulus package. That includes $281 billion in tax cuts, $283 billion in government spending, and $263 billion in direct payments. We'll talk about some of the specifics of that. What happens now is the House, as you know, passed their version, which was $820 billion last week. And so there will now be a debate, a little more debate in the Senate. It's expected to be perhaps voted on as early as Tuesday. And this will follow a press conference by the President of the United States tomorrow night, his first nationally televised press conference since assuming the presidency. So he will be going to the American people, trying to gin up support for a compromise between the House version and the Senate version. We'll talk about some of the specifics as the program unfolds. But I do want to mention that Robert Janetsky is with us. He's a noted economist. And, Bob, nice to have you back on Beyond the Beltway.
It's great to be back in Chicago, Bruce.
In 100 or 150 or 200 words or less, what's your assessment of the economic stimulus package and economic stimulus as a government policy to begin with?
Well, I believe the package is misnamed. My bottom line conclusion is it's going to be highly destructive. We have a great deal of evidence on government spending in general. A lot of studies have been done, and these studies have come basically to a consensus that roughly half of what the government spends is wasted. So we now spend over $3 trillion a year through our federal government. That means we waste $150 billion a year. What if the bill comes out to be the $800 billion that we're now talking about, it means that we're going to waste another $400 billion. Wasting money is not a good way to help the economy. It's going to hurt.
And Dan Johnson Weinberger, our Democrat tonight, your reaction to that brutal assessment of what the government's trying to do?
Well, that has to be among the most, to my new good friend, I'd have to say among the most ridiculous assessments I've ever heard of government spending, that half of it is wasted. I think the context, which is important here, is that we are facing the biggest economic crisis since the Great Depression, and we're shedding jobs faster than, a woman in a sauna on a diet shedding pounds. We are in big trouble, and we're losing jobs fast. And the only institution that can spend the money we need to get people working again is the federal government, which doesn't have any balanced budget.
Our Republican is Chris Voronis. So you take a different view.
Very different, but similar to Bob's. This was a very bad week for the Obama administration, not just on trying to shepherd through the stimulus package, but also the embarrassments with his nominees, the chief performance officer, Daschle.
But let's focus on the economic.
Right. So basically what you had was Obama starting off with a note of bipartisanship, but he let Pelosi and Reid write the whole stimulus package, kept the Republicans out, didn't get one single Republican vote. And now we're at a juncture in the Senate where they're shedding back $100 billion, an indication that what came out of the House wasn't a good idea.
But again, I mean, he was able to get some Republicans, three Republicans, Olympia Snowe, Susan Collins of Maine, and Arlen Specter. He did get three Republicans, and based on what they did in the Senate, they were able to, as you say, cut $110 billion off the initial base Senate bill, which was 920. So in his efforts, I mean the president's efforts to be bipartisan, he did
And he bent over, right, they bent over backwards in the House. There are all sorts of Republican provisions, including net carryback losses, that all sorts of tax cuts that the Republicans wanted, and none of them voted for it.
But, well, so let me get back to the economics here.
Sure.
To begin with, the government doesn't have any money. Okay, they really don't. I mean, they have the money they take in from taxes, but they've already spent it, plus they've spent $250, $300, $350 billion more. When the government doesn't have any money and it wants to spend it, what it has to do is it has to go out and sell bonds. When it sells bonds, it takes money out of the economy. It takes savings that were originally set to go into investment, takes that money out, and then spends it. And as I said, the research is very clear on this. In my book, A Nation of Millionaires, I list a number of studies that have been done in a number of different fields that show this 50% waste that Dan says is ridiculous. You ought to be familiar with the studies. Now, last year, remember, we had a $170 billion stimulus program. Before the program was passed, I said, what's going to happen here? You've got tight credit markets. The government somehow thinks it makes sense to go into those very tight credit markets and borrow an additional $170 billion, get it out of there, and write people checks. Well, what happened was businesses, which could have gotten that money, didn't get it. Individuals got it, and the government, when the money is transferred from where the market would put it into the rest of the economy, that's when you do the damage. That's what history shows.
Dan, I want to just follow up on that, and that is the ability of Congress, when they start to dabble in things that they really can, as Bob suggests, they can make things worse. And let's look at the bailout. It's too early to tell about the automobile industry.
Right.
But let's talk about, you know, the financial, you know, the banks. The fact that so much money has already been sent out to them, and there doesn't appear to be anybody in Congress who knows where that money went, and money that at least I think the general public thought was going to go to their banks, so their banks could in turn could provide some loans to either save people from having their homes foreclosed or small business to create, you know, business and expand the economy. None of that's happened. And by the way, that's we're talking about something that's happened within the last 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
So how can the average American have any confidence at all that now suddenly, you know, a new stimulus package, which is far bigger price tag, how can anybody have confidence that that's going to work?
Well, it's clear, and it's a fair point, but here's the difference. Number one is the difference between what we're trying to do now and what the financial bailout was is we're trying to spend money on creating jobs for Americans who need them and trying to stop state governments from going absolutely in the red, cut off unemployment benefits, get people working again. That's different than what the financial bailout package was, which was to stop the financial market from collapsing. I think it was fair to say that there wasn't nearly enough transparency in the Bush administration's handling the first half of the financial bailout package. The second half hasn't happened yet. And new Treasury Secretary Geithner is going to explain and come up with his plan for what to do with the second half. But I think it's fair to say that the second half is going to be handled in a much more transparent manner than the first half.
It may be transparent, but the economic effects are basically the same.
And we're going to go to a break, but I also want to talk about the importance of consumer confidence or voter confidence, and we'll do that when we come back. 1-800-723-8029. From coast to coast and border to border, I'm Bruce Dumont every Sunday night. From Rochester, New York to Fresno, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Bob Janetsky is here. He is an economist, and you heard some things during that last segment that got you riled up.
Well, the thing is, we're talking about fiscal stimulus, the government coming in here, spending money and creating jobs. And I think what's important to do is to go back and look at the history of fiscal stimulus. Now, there are a number of cases where the government has come in, spent money, and the economy has done well. Those cases are when the Federal Reserve also printed a lot of money. And there are cases when the government cut back on spending and the economy did not do well. Lo and behold, there are some cases there when that happened where the Federal Reserve did not create a lot of money. But there are occasions in history, very dramatic ones, where the two went in different directions. That is, where the Federal Reserve Board was creating a lot of money, but the government was cutting back massively. The first one that I want to bring up, and incidentally, all this evidence is on my website because I don't like people who talk about things and can't back it up. ClassicalPrinciples.com. You can see the history going back for the past 90 years of government spending, what the effect has been on the economy, and also monetary policy when the Fed was doing it. In the 1920s, the early 1920s, we had a 50% cut in government spending. My goodness, based on the theory of fiscal stimulus. And we had a cut in taxes, but the Fed was creating more money, and it ushered in, as you suggested, the Roaring Twenties. Now, in the early 1930s, the Great Depression, we had the opposite. Government increased its spending by 50%. Does that sound familiar? And what happened? The Federal Reserve cut the amount of money in the system, and we went into the Great Depression. Those are two of the most dramatic periods of economic change with respect to government spending, and they are damning.
But a perception about how America got out of the Depression, I want you to comment on it. The impression is that Roosevelt came in with all these big, you know, make work projects, and that we really we spent our way out of the Depression, and that's how we got out of the Depression.
Okay, what happened in 19?
What really happened
in 1933-34? Two things happened. The government did spend a lot more money, but the Federal Reserve finally got money into the system. So they're both going in the same direction, and we had a recovery for about 3 years. Then what happened is the government stopped spending money and the Federal Reserve cut the money supply again, and we went into a downward phase, a second downward phase of the Great Depression.
And when did the war come in?
1941, okay. We started to see the buildup.
Deep in the process.
Yeah, and 1942 is when it was.
And the reality is that the Civilian Conservation Corps didn't end the Great Depression, and the jobs that are going to be created if the stimulus package passed are neo-civilian conservation corps jobs that are bubble jobs. They're not long-term jobs. They're not jobs that private business creates.
And guess what?
Private business needs credit.
Guess what?
That's the issue. And if businesses can't borrow money to invest in their businesses, jobs aren't going to be created, and people aren't going to be spending money on an economy that's based on two-thirds consumer spending.
But what Secretary Geithner is going to announce tomorrow, he's going to announce where some of the next dollars are supposed to go, above and beyond the $350 billion that's already gone in, that went down the rat hole that nobody knows where it's at. But the question is, might he provide that stimulus? Might those dollars be going to the banks with some sort of a caveat now that you have to spend it, you've got to put it in to make it available to those that need it either to save their homes or to build great jobs?
We don't know. And there's talk of this bad bank being created. Right now, banks are very uncertain. There's too many. The depth of these toxic assets are much deeper than anyone ever imagined. So banks kind of want to ride it out and see what's going to happen.
Do you agree with Chris's point?
No, Bob? Not really. There are several different things going on here. One thing in terms of the belief that Geithner has the solution. Geithner has been working on this stuff for quite some time. He was, of course, vice chairman of the Federal Reserve during a period, incidentally, when we were off air during the break. We started to talk about, surely the private sector failed in the past year. My analysis is no, the government failed. The government always creates these problems and then have business arguing against labor, against other people, and everyone's pointing fingers at Wall Street and everyone else. The government created the problem. The Federal Reserve Board, in the past 4 years, has spent three of those 4 years reducing the amount of funds available to the banking system. Actually, high-powered money has come down. There is only one other time in history where that has happened, and that was 1929 to 1933. That's only one of the things the government has done to create this current economic mess that we have.
Yeah. Well, I think it's silly to take the view, and I think that's the failed ideology that I think has bankrupted the Republican Party, that government is the problem. That's That's sort of the era of Reagan. That's what I'm hearing our friend Bob say, that government's always the problem.
Are you familiar with the money supply figures?
But do you know what's happening?
Yeah,
and the problem, and our monetary policy is important, and you're right, that half of it is fiscal policy,
and you're
half of it is
monetary
policy.
And you're familiar that we've had the worst monetary policy
And our problem
since
with
Great
our monetary
Depression?
Policy right now is that the Federal Reserve is basically at a 0% interest rate. They're trying to open
Which
up the floodgates as much as they can,
That's the same
right?
thing they said in 1933.
So that all we have left, so that based on your logic, If we have no tools left for monetary policy to open up more credit, which I agree, we ought to open up as much credit as possible, then what's left is to stimulate on the fiscal policy.
You don't understand
the
monetary
money.
Policy. It's the same argument the Fed made in the 30s.
But
and everyone now realizes
Dan, you're also,
that
I mean, part of the point I was getting before the break, and that is you have to acknowledge, however, that government frequently does make the problem worse, and they do create problems. You can't – I mean, you know, you took a kind of a swipe at Reagan. I mean the reality is, don't you have to acknowledge that a lot of these problems have been created by government?
I think –
I mean, look at Freddie Mae. I mean, somebody sent me a Wall Street Journal article from about 12 years ago last week. Roger Keach used to be a state senator. You know what the story is? It's the story of the Clinton administration, and I don't mean – to yeah. criticize the Clinton, but we're going to – let's deal with the facts here.
Yeah, right.
The Clinton administration urging Congress that they had to loosen up the rules so they could get more people, low and middle income people, involved in the housing markets. So they were reducing their requirements so people could get into the housing market. Now, aren't those the same people now who can't pay their mortgages and that have led to the foreclosure crisis we have in the
country? Well, look –
because, again, good intentions – good intentions, bad consequences, and it wasn't Ronald Reagan. It goes back to, again, government trying to do something that they shouldn't be involved in doing.
Look, the idea that government is the problem or government is the solution are both similarly simple-minded. The idea is that we're past that ideological way of talking about government. It's now trying to be as practical and pragmatic as possible. It's not like the government's going away, right? There's no such thing as a private economy without the government creating property rights. So the question always is, what is the smartest way that the government can help stimulate the economy? Because right now, it sure doesn't look like, with the worst job losses since the Great Depression, you know, absent a government stimulus program, things are going to be turning around anytime soon.
So putting monetary policy aside, and most people think there's nothing we could do there. We're at zero or near zero.
That's only people who don't understand anything
let's just indulge Dan's line
Which
of logic.
Which you agree with, Chris.
Let's just indulge Dan's line of logic on the fiscal policy, job creation. What kind of jobs would this stimulus package create if it was passed? What kind of jobs would there be?
I think we would avoid tremendous layoffs in state and local government. I think we'd generate tremendous construction jobs. In my opinion, our infrastructure piece of the stimulus package is way light, and it should be a lot heavier.
The biggest fraud of this stimulus package is the quote-unquote shovel-ready jobs. What if you're not talking about resodding the National Mall, you're talking about construction jobs that are dependent upon regulatory agencies issuing permits, citing issues. These are very – these jobs won't go into effect until the end of this year and
Chris,
into next year.
Chris, that's not true.
We need jobs right now, Dan.
Let me tell you – let me just – one last thing because the – remember the point I made earlier. The government doesn't have the money. They've got to sell bonds in order to get the money, get the spending power out of some people's hands in order to put it in other people's hands. What does that mean? It means tighter credit markets. My son happens to be – just got elected state representative in Michigan.
Congratulations.
And he – and of course, as state representative, all the people from the area, a very depressed area, are coming to him with their problems. He said, you can't believe the problems the businessmen have. He said – they said, yeah, times are rough, but if we could get credit – we could get through this period. He said, we can't get it. It's not available. Why isn't it available? Because the government, with its stimulus program that they've had going for the past year, has been taking it away and selling bonds. And when it sells bonds, it takes that credit away. You're damaging with the left hand, and you're trying to help with
the
right hand.
That's not why we have a credit crisis. We have a credit crisis because the master of the universe of Wall Street decided to take a lot of those unpayable mortgages that Bruce was talking about and created these fancy financial instruments that they then got an incredible orgy of risk and leveraged their banks up to the hilt. And now that the orgy of risk and greed has come to a close and the reality is these assets are close to worthless, it's not because the government's trying to buy some bad assets. It's because they don't have – they made horrible, horrible investments.
Bob, for those listening around the country who have heard you and say, you know what, right on. What if – let me ask you a what if. What if the government does nothing? Give us your scenario. What happens?
Well, rather than do nothing, my recommendation would be just the opposite. I would say cut government spending by $1 trillion and write people checks for that amount of money. At the same time that you're doing that, have the Federal Reserve get money into the system. This argument that all of a sudden Wall Street is to blame. Incidentally, same argument they used in the 1930s. Wall Street is all of a sudden greedy when the economy collapses. When the economy is doing well, no one's greedy. Greed is a natural inherent characteristic of people. It always exists. The thing that's similar now to the early 1930s is the Federal Reserve has cut high-powered money for 3 years in a row, and there's no other period that they've done that other than the early 1930s. All of a sudden, people are greedy because there's no money around.
Back shortly from Chicago with your calls. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Joining us tonight, our Republican is Chris Voronis. He is a public relations executive. Our Democrat is Dan Johnson Weinberger. He is a progressive lobbyist with his own firm in the Chicagoland area. And Robert Janetsky is here. He is an economist, graduate of Eastern Illinois University and New York University, which is where you got your PhD for 17 years, chief economist for the Harris Bank, and is one of the country's premier interest rate forecasters and well-known for his research and advocacy of classical economic principles. And his website is classicalprinciples.com.
Right.
And that we can get all the bells and whistles, all the follow-through, all the graphs and charts that go along with basically what he is saying this evening. I want to just go back and talk about one thing, and then we're going to get to calls because we have a lot of callers. Again, as most people listening to the program know, I am the president of the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. I've been talking about our project, which has been stalled for over a year and a half due to a broken promise by Governor Rod Blagojevich. Thank God he's gone.
Hear, hear.
But the reality is that this project is one of the most shovel-ready projects in America. Could be ready to go within 3 weeks, completed in 10 months, created about 200 construction jobs, 21 permanent jobs. It would be an economic engine and a tourist capacity in the city of Chicago. But last week, in the debates that were going on in the Senate, Tom Colburn, Republican of Oklahoma, he sponsored an amendment. It was approved 73-24. And listen to what this amendment says. None of the amounts appropriated or otherwise made available by this act may be used for any casino or other gambling establishment, aquarium, zoo, golf course, swimming pool, stadium, community park, museum, theater, art center, and highway beautification projects. And he did it because he wants to ensure that taxpayer money is not lost on wasteful and non-stimulative projects. And I would like to know from Tom Colburn, obviously, this has a lot of people in the arts community upset. And frankly, I'm advocating right now, I think it's a bad amendment. I hope it gets thrown out. Because it seems to me that when you lump a casino in with a museum, you don't understand the difference between the two.
Right.
Now, granted, they both may be creating jobs, but one I think is operating, with the good of the public. But when you get into sports stadiums, some of these things I might agree with. But again, I think the concept to say that willy nilly, there's just going to be a decision that's going to be made that you can't spend money on worthy projects. It seems to me the key thing is they have to be worthy projects. And here's a question I would like to ask, and then we are going to calls. Because $40 billion was carved out of this package by the Senate because they don't want it to go to state governments.
Right.
Wouldn't state governments have a better understanding of where the money could be spent in their states more so than some congressional committee in Washington? Chris Voronis?
I've always believed that. Back to the block grant days of the 60s and 70s. And there's a small voice in Congress advocating for such a move.
Well, the Senate Republicans cut out every state government left him to dry. The deficits that state governments are facing are mind-boggling.
Well, and they didn't leave it dry. I mean, they cut $40 billion.
$40 billion is a lot of money.
But there's still 39 million in, so it's like they do have something.
That's a massive. Okay. Look, California
it's
by itself
cut.
Is a $40 billion deficit. Illinois's got a $9 billion deficit. There's going to be major layoffs in state governments and the social service providers that rely on it. Because we decided, you know,
Bob, you think all government spending is a waste? Would you acknowledge that maybe those closest to an issue or closest to the ground might know a project better than some bureaucrat in Washington?
Yes, but I would disagree with you in suggesting that Washington should raise the money. Again, you're taking it out of one pocket, putting it into another. You can point out all the jobs you want to point out that you're creating with the money you spend. If you're going to be fair, you have to point out the jobs you've destroyed by taking that money out of other people's pockets when you floated the bonds.
But, let's go to calls. Let's go to Bill in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listening to us on, are you listening to us on the internet or
yes,
on
sir.
WLS tonight,
yes,
Bill?
Yes, I am, sir. Good. On the internet. Bruce, I thank you very much because I consider this the most important call, the most serious situation that I have ever discussed in my decades of calling. And I ask PhD Janetsky to pay close attention because most people do not understand the situation that we're talking about here. Heretofore, three-quarters of our gross national product was based on consumer spending. I repeat, three-quarters, 73% of our gross national product was based on consumer spending. That means we are on a spending spree. That's over with. It's gone. Basically, it comes down to we have no industries in the United States. There has never been a civilization in recorded history that did not have industries that built things and sold things. This is the point that everybody's missing. And I'll go into the deficit in just a minute and who's responsible and all those particulars. But Mr. Obama is trying to do two things. He's trying an immediate stimulus, which you people have been talking about, what the Republicans have been talking about. That means just priming the pumps, getting some stop this hemorrhaging of job loss. That means work projects and DPW type things. That does not produce an economic viability. It puts people to work temporarily, just like FDR did, but it did not produce the economy. We must lay the foundations for a true economic system, or we are finished as a nation and an economy. What does that mean? Obama has talked about building alternate energy pathways. That's a golden gate for California because of their wind power. We have solar power energies. Joe Biden has talked about developing clean coal technology that we can sell to China. The point I'm making is we have to lay the foundations. This is what people don't understand. They're talking about creating jobs. Jobs for what? What? There's no industry here. What, people are going to go out and spend some more and buy four things of already the three things that they didn't need? No one is grasping this situation to the extent that it is. The point is, one, there should be an immediate stimulus just to stop the hemorrhaging, put them to work building bridges, whatever you want, but that does not produce economic viability until you lay the foundations, and that's what he's all about. Lay the foundations for a true economic infrastructure, an economic infrastructure, whatever it might be, you will not produce a viable economy, which this country has been lacking.
Let's let Bob and everybody respond to that.
Bob,
but first of all, you mentioned energy. The Senate bill provides $40 billion for various energy programs, and you talk about, you know, direct payments. The Senate bill calls for $17 billion to give one-time grants, $300 payments to Social Security recipients, poor people on supplemental security income, and veterans receiving disability and pensions. So they're going to get a check for $300.
Yeah,
what are they going to do with it?
You know, we tried that last year. The $170 billion, they wrote checks to people. The missing link, again, is that they had to go and take the money away from others. Before they did that, when they took it away from others, they created more problems in the credit markets.
So I think the caller's right that we just sending checks to people is not that helpful. Investing in an infrastructure that gives us long-term prosperity is. And fortunately, I don't think the piece is big enough in the stimulus package, but there is a significant amount of money, significant investment in a smarter energy grid so we can start using renewables and break our addiction to foreign oil. There's a lot of money in there for computerizing our medical records so that we can get a more sane healthcare system. And there's some money for transportation infrastructure because we haven't invested nearly enough in our transportation infrastructure, and the costs of a bad transportation infrastructure make it more difficult for us to be prosperous. So I think about a third to a half of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Plan does what the caller is looking to do, which is invest in infrastructure.
Well, I call it the Fleecing of America Act, and the basic assumption is that people in the government are better at spending the money and can spend it more efficiently and on better things, all the things that Dan suggested, as opposed to the market system. And that has never worked in any country at any point in time.
Does one element of this, which again the House did not, there was no provision in the House bill, but there is in the Senate bill, $11 billion to make interest payments on most automobile loans and sales tax on new cars deductible if a car is bought in 2009. Does that help with the bailout issue that we've also been dealing with? Does that help in any way?
You know, the biggest thing to help would be for the Fed to get more money into the economy. And they have not done that yet. They're starting. It's just starting. It's coming very late. When that money gets in, Bruce, this economy is going to see a boom in spending. The problem is if we put this stimulus, so-called stimulus thing at the same time, although spending will boom, a lot of the spending will occur in an inefficient way, and that's going to hurt people.
But sure, won't it help buy more cars and the other tax cut for
housing? Taking the money out of one pocket and putting it into another.
Except the pocket is the future, right? We're going into debt, and we Americans are going to pay off this debt over the next 10 or 20 or 30 years. So the pocket we're taking out of is our pockets a decade or two decades from now, plus the interest, right?
Spend it wastefully. That's not a solution.
Let's go to Bob in Youngstown listening to us on WKBN. Go ahead, Bob. You're on the air.
You mean Alan?
Alan, I'm sorry. I thought it was Bob.
Okay.
We've got a Bob there, too, but go ahead.
Hey, I agree with the last caller to one extent. We have sold off all of our industry. We can't really produce anything in this country. The loop is going to be open. In other words, whatever money we pump into this, sooner or later somebody wants to spend their money on something, and that means it leaves the country and goes somewhere else. But beyond that, I totally disagree. We shouldn't be pumping in any more government money. This country has been on this drunken jag for so many years now. Export the jobs, import the cheap labor, do anything it takes so that people don't have to really work hard and can enjoy all the life that they want to enjoy. Well, I got news. The jag is over. The migraine headache is coming. And all we're going to do is postpone it with all this. And
we got to go. Take a breath. We're going to a break. 1-800-723-8289. More from Chicago. From Sioux Falls, South Dakota to Boise, Idaho, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Let's head to Eddie listening to us in Chicago on our flagship station, WLS. Go ahead.
Yeah, great show. I think one thing that they haven't talked about is for the young people, educational classes to help people manage their money and save their money, how to use a credit card.
Yep.
I don't hear anything about that. I mean, I have an 800 credit score, and I didn't need anybody telling me how to manage my money.
That may be a good idea, but it is not it sort of follows up on something. A conversation we had a couple of weeks ago, Bob, which is basically if you graduate from elementary school in America, you have no concept of what the economic system is in the country that people live in. So we were talking about that. But this does not, nor I think should, have any impact on that because it creates knowledge. It doesn't create jobs. By the way, in the Senate bill, $16 billion was cut from the Senate bill, from what the House wanted to do just for school construction. And that, at least initially, along with roads and bridges, was something that was very high on everybody's list, but obviously not high on those in the Senate.
It's just too bad.
Let's take another call. Let's go to Greg listening to us on I-75 in Ohio. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. How are you?
Okay.
Good. How are you?
Good. I'm a business owner, and I've read some economics
books and things, and I've taken some economics classes, and it just absolutely cracks me up when here you have a doctor of economics who knows what he's talking about. And I read the book last year or 2 years ago, FDR's Folly, by an economist that just crucified the Roosevelt administration and proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that all that spending that he did nothing to really get the economy where they intended it to go. And it was, in fact, World War II that saved the American economy from just a complete disaster.
Which was
so
spending,
it looks
right?
like we're getting ready to repeat history again. And the economist gentleman there has said that several times and cited facts and figures. And then you have the Democrat guy, like almost all Democrats, when they're confronted with facts and figures, they go things like, oh, that's not true, or that's not how I feel, or things like that. Well, I left the Democratic Party 25 years ago because I got sick and tired of the feelings. And I wanted to deal in reality.
Well, listen,
I don't understand why
respond
the Democrat
to
guy doesn't want to confront history where all of this spending has failed.
Let's let Dan respond. Greg, stay on the line.
So Greg, you know, there weren't any facts and figures that were actually presented, just a reference to tons of studies which none of us have seen and a website which none of us have had the opportunity to review. But if you want to talk about what economists think, last time I checked, the guy that just won the Nobel Prize in economics, which is the best economist in the world, right? This guy named Paul Krugman.
No.
Right?
No.
Oh,
if you go on my website.
I'm going to finish my point.
Okay.
So if you want to think about what economists think, the guy who's recognized by economists as the top guy this year is the one saying what we need is more a bigger stimulus package. And what the media says and what most economists are saying, according to the papers that I read, say most economists think we probably need a bigger stimulus package
and
to deal with our job loss.
And Dan, if you go to my website, I've got Krugman's article verbatim along with my response as to how poorly he understands both monetary policy and history.
And also, didn't one of – is it Marty Feldstein?
With the Reagan administration.
Now – He has come out and said that he could support this. Did he not?
Well, first he said he supported it. Then he took a look at it, and my understanding is he doesn't support it. But again, the question is not who supports it. Is this guy the best? Use your common sense. Look at history. Look at the effects of these things in the past, and decide on your own.
Here's my look at common sense. You can have if all of the economists in the world agreed, which doesn't happen, if they all agreed on doing something, if it doesn't pass political muster, it's not going to happen. And what we're dealing here, I mean, we have elected members of Congress who are reading in the newspapers, who are hearing stories when they go back to their respective congressional districts or states, and they're seeing their description of pain. People are angry. People want something – they want something done.
Yeah.
And in many cases, if you do something in a time of crisis, sometimes you can do the wrong thing and make it worse. There's no question about that. But in this particular case, would you acknowledge, Bob, that because we live in this political cauldron here, politicians, well-meaning, even though they may not be intellectually
absolutely,
you know, premised like you might be on the subject – they're going to try to do something because what they want to do more than anything else is they want to please their constituents because they want to get reelected.
Let me shock part of the audience here. I want to see President Obama succeed.
So do I.
I don't want to see the pain. Most people don't want to see this pain continue. My thing is, if you look at history, what he is doing, what he is recommending is going to make things worse. And when things get worse, I just hope that he is as intelligent as so many people feel he is and that he recognizes it soon enough to turn this thing around, because spending $1 trillion or so wastefully is not going
to
do it.
Let's go to Turner listening, driving in Iowa. Go ahead, Turner. You're on the air.
Hey there.
Yes.
I had a couple of
thoughts. You got a minute.
All right. First of all, I want to just contribute that the idea of shovel-ready projects being a myth, I hear people say that sometimes, and there's kind of some uncertainty there. I know for a fact, at least in Missouri, we have shovel-ready projects. Missouri actually held a bid letting on the 20th of January, has winners in line, ready to sign contracts and start turning dirt. So that's certainly possible within the transportation infrastructure industry.
Yep.
I agree.
Yeah,
I certainly agree. I know of one, but again, it's It's on the you-know-what list right now.
And how can we say those are wasteful spending, getting better roads, better bridges, better transit systems?
And let me throw something out. You know, I mean,
30 seconds.
All right, particularly in the area of bridges, we need that. Another area of infrastructure they're working on is increasing our grid system for the electrical, for the power lines.
Yep.
And that's really fundamental. I think spending will have to do, we draw it closer to us. And it's one of those things that feeds a growth curve in our economy. So that's something that I think if we can get some of that going as well as the regular infrastructure, it's not money thrown away.
Turner, we're going to move forward. Listen, they're going to vote on it in the Senate on Tuesday, but again, it's going to go into conference. So we'll have an opportunity to talk about this again next week. Bob Janetsky, thank you very much. ClassicalPrinciples.com. ClassicalPrinciples.com. That's your website. Thank you very much for joining us. 17 years as the chief economist for Harris Bank in Chicago. When we come back, a whole full hour, and we're going to be talking about perhaps the greatest president of all time, Abraham Lincoln, coming up next on Beyond the Beltway. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Gary Johnson, president of the Chicago History Museum and Lincoln Scholar, Democrat Dan Johnson Weinberger, and Republican Chris Voronis. Our program coming to you from the SiriusXM studios on Chicago's Great West Side, where our phone lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. And in the history of this program, which first went on the air, as many of you know, back in 1980, we have talked about a lot of presidents. We've taken hundreds of calls about every president who has been president and some who were president before this program went on the air. And tonight, for the next hour, we're going to be talking about the president that we don't talk much about, and that is Abraham Lincoln. As many of you know, this coming Thursday, on the 12th of February, it will mark the 200th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's birth in this great state of Kentucky. And we are going to be talking about Abraham Lincoln. And also, there's going to be a lot of focus wherever you turn. I would assume for the next week, there's going to be a lot of Lincoln-esque discussions. And the President of the United States, Barack Obama, will be returning to Springfield, Illinois, from whence came Abraham Lincoln politically. He will be going there on Thursday of this coming week, and he will be participating in activities of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. But joining us in the first segment of our program this evening is fellow museum president, Gary Johnson. He's president of the Chicago History Museum. Gary, nice to have you with us on Beyond the Beltway. And I invited Gary to be with us because a couple of weeks ago, he gave a wonderful lecture to the Chicago City Club talking about Abraham Lincoln. And I'd like to begin by talking about certainly in all of our lifetimes, we have known that Lincoln has been revered and is described as the greatest American president, or certainly one of the top two or three great American presidents. But when did the greatness of Lincoln, when did that begin to become part of America's conscience, Gary?
Well, I think it especially hit home when he was assassinated. He became immediately a sort of Christ-like sacrificial figure who took on almost a kind of deification. Now, that progressed from one stage to another. He had been admired by many, during his presidency, but he had always been controversial. But from the time of his death, he took on a different kind of status. His funeral train was a major event as it went through the country. In Chicago, for example, which was its last major stop before Springfield, there were just thousands and thousands of people who came out.
And in looking at Lincoln, obviously, the Civil War and the Emancipation Proclamation is the focal point of his presidency. But what are some of the other things that Abraham Lincoln did that maybe the average person is not aware of?
Well, what intrigues me is that even though he was in crisis, he managed to put in place the building blocks for a post-crisis America. He made it possible for the Transcontinental Railroad to be built by signing the act that made that possible. The Homestead Act, which became very, very important as a building block for growth in the United States. He made it possible for the land-grant colleges to become part of our educational system post-war. It was the era when a national currency was established. So I think, especially when we think about where we are now as a nation, where we know we're in a kind of economic financial crisis, the real trick is to look beyond the crisis and say, what do we need now to build a world after the crisis? And Lincoln somehow managed to do that.
And also, it was during his presidency that we had our first income tax, of an income tax. The Department of Agriculture was formed, and even Thanksgiving became somewhat codified during his
presidency.
Right,
a standard holiday. It had been the tradition for governors and presidents to announce Thanksgiving, but for various occasions, but now it became an actual national holiday with a regular calendar. The income tax he did initiate, and it did help finance the war, but then it didn't come back again after it was repealed for a number of years.
Now, obviously, there's been a lot of comparison between he and Barack Obama, because Barack Obama came from Illinois. Abraham Lincoln was the first president to be elected from Illinois, and Barack Obama certainly announced his presidential aspirations for president in the old state capitol in Springfield on a very, very cold day, and came back to Springfield when he announced Joe Biden as his running mate. But going back to his early political days, if you were to compare that political pedigree that he had or credentials that he had, he virtually would not have been taken very seriously in contemporary American politics.
No, he won. He lost far more elections than he won. He had only served one term in Congress. A congressional seat in those days was a little different than it is today. The number of months when you actually sat in Washington was quite limited. So his experience with Washington, with the national scene, was very limited. It was not the kind of background that even Barack Obama had, which was relatively brief in national office by today's standards.
But he did. He spent four terms as a member of the Illinois General Assembly.
Correct.
And then also, again, 2 years in Congress. Then he ran for the Senate, lost. Then a couple of years later, he's selected to be a candidate for vice president, but then sort of declines that, and in 1860 becomes the very first Republican candidate for president.
Right. But the interesting thing about his losing race for the Senate in 1858, the year of the great Lincoln-Douglas debates, it was a case of losing the election but maybe winning the war, in the sense that he made sure that there was a word for word transcript of those debates. There was a Chicago Tribune reporter who came around and kept a copy of everything. Lincoln self-published the transcript of those debates, circulated it nationwide. It helped to enhance his status as an important politician, even though he did lose that election. Very smart tactically.
And he also gave a major speech in New York City prior to his ascension, which really helped make him a somewhat national figure, obviously, before any electronic or even significant newspaper coverage.
That's right. The Cooper Union speech, which is still remembered as a very important national coming out party for him, one where he did make an impression on the East Coast.
With Horace Greeley.
Now, interestingly enough, the first time Abraham Lincoln came to the then-growing city of Chicago, when he was a young man, there was a convention here in the 1840s. Horace Greeley was in attendance and did notice this young man from Springfield. So they had a history. And it wasn't always an easy history, the two of them.
You made a very interesting point in the lecture that I heard, and that was how Abraham Lincoln became sort of popular and well-known even before he became elected to anything, and we'll talk about that. 1-800-723-8289, talking about Abraham Lincoln tonight on Beyond the Beltway. From Lincoln, Nebraska to Lincoln, Illinois, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, and thank you very much for joining us tonight. A Focus special broadcast this evening celebrating the 200th birthday of Abraham Lincoln. It's coming up on Thursday, and this is an opportunity for you, wherever you're listening, from coast to coast and border to border, to offer your thoughts or questions. If there's a question you ever had about Abraham Lincoln, everybody listening to the broadcast this evening remembers sort of the basic things about Abraham Lincoln going to grammar school or when you were going to grammar school. But tonight we're talking about some other aspects of it, and also a huge celebration that will be taking place this coming Thursday, the 200th celebration, 200th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's birth. And joining us for this interview, we have our Democrat, our card-carrying Democrat, is Dan Johnson Weinberger, joins us, and our card-carrying Republican, celebrating the very first Republican president, Chris Voronis, joins us as well. And, gentlemen, I think you had a question for Gary Johnson, the president of the Chicago History Museum. Chris Voronis, to you.
Gary, you certainly hear a lot about Lincoln being a great American president. A few people would dispute that. You don't hear much about Lincoln, the savvy politician. And certainly there's a lot of evidence to that point. Can you talk a little bit about Lincoln the politician and how he advanced his career? And I think you even mentioned he was smart enough to look ahead and recognize he could carve out a space for himself as
right.
being against the expansion of slavery.
Well, on the political side, I think the Doris Kearns Goodwin book, Team of Rivals, epitomizes one of his strategies, which was when he became president, he actually assembled his former rivals for the presidency in his own party, put them in his cabinet. Keep your friends close and your enemies closer. And I think Lincoln would be amused that all these years later, Barack Obama adopted that policy. The idea that you would read Lincoln's career as a kind of business book, that's how to put it together. But he certainly did do that. It didn't solve all problems. Salmon Chase, who was his Secretary of the Treasury, threatened to run against him for the Republican nomination in 1864. But he kept his arms around these people, and generally it worked.
Dan Johnson Weinberg's got a comment.
Well, related to that question, how was he with congressional relations? Did he mix it up a lot with, you know, the Whigs that were still in the House as a former House members? Was he like Barack, at least in Barack's first 2 weeks, actively engaged with working with members of the House and the Senate? Was Lincoln like that too?
I think, in fairness, he was more focused on the executive side of his job rather than the legislative side. Members of his cabinet were far more experienced than he was at working with Congress, and he was focused on running the war and serving as the chief executive.
He was more of a micromanager somewhat in the early days of the war, did he not? Was he not? And then sort of, you know, when Grant took over, he sort of, waved him on a little bit more or was a little more comfortable with him?
Well, he was a micromanager in the sense that he was hungry for information. In fact, there's a book out that talks about him and his obsession with the telegrams that came every night. In a way, he's portrayed as a kind of early adopter, the sort of person who would be using his BlackBerry as Obama does. He was very hungry for detailed information, and after the day at the White House, he would go and they'd have the telegrams ready for him. With regard to him as a war leader, for the first few years, it was a mixture of a detailed concern about what was happening, but then maybe not acting quickly enough to replace generals who were struggling, as General McClellan was, who was so reluctant to join battle.
Also, one of the, I think I've referenced this once or twice on the program in the past, but somewhere in my background, I am related, a distant relative to General Halleck, who was chief of staff to President Lincoln during the Civil War. And the reading that I have done about him, including a recent book, he was not a very popular fellow. But again, he was a detailed person, but he had sort of a very on-again, off-again relationship with President Lincoln.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. But, you know, with...
And found Grant, but then didn't trust him.
Right, right. And Grant succeeded, and Lincoln, you know, had his hat off to him as he succeeded, even though there were these rumors of Grant drinking and so forth, rumors that weren't denied mm-hmm. by Lincoln. But let me just say one thing about his political skills, something that people don't realize. If you study Lincoln, one of the things that you hear about all the time is that he was inundated in the White House with office seekers. People would come and they'd want a job, they'd want to be postmaster of whatever town they lived in. He was there shaking hands and receiving visitors all day. People wring their hands and say, what a waste of time. It wasn't a waste of time. There were no political polls in those days. He was taking soundings of how the electorate felt about everything going on in the country. This was a very shrewd man who had his ear to the ground rather than an uncontrolled manager.
Before the break, we talked about things that he was sort of planning before he certainly made a name for himself. And it seems to me like nowadays we know that politicians sort of are calculating and shrewd, and they sort of chart their own political future. But there's some indication that Abraham Lincoln was somewhat like that as well, because he became fairly well known in Chicago. Again, you know, was even asked to give to write an obituary for Zachary Taylor, the president, when he died. Now, how does a corporate lawyer right. working on railroads in Illinois, how does he get an assignment like that?
Well, I've been able to confirm 24 visits to Chicago, at least. It was actually part of his circuit riding as a lawyer. We think of him representing widows and orphans in central Illinois, but he came to Chicago at least 24 times. Most of those times, he had legal work, but almost all of those times, he was out and about mixing with the local politicians, making a name for himself. As the only Whig elected to Congress in the year when he was elected, he was kind of an exotic animal to begin with in a state which was not a Whig state. That gave him a certain notoriety, but he was there with Chicago local politicians like Long John Wentworth and many others.
And the relationship also, again, he was astute about the press, because early on, he obviously had made some friends with Horace Greeley, who was the major newspaper publisher and editor in the East, but he also he caught the eye of Joseph Medill, the founder of the Chicago Tribune.
Joseph Medill was not only a great newspaper man, but was one of the conveners of the Republican Party. And Medill had in mind that the 1860 convention needed to be in Chicago, and then worked hard to bring the local crowd into the picture.
And Medill, and he was a kingmaker for Lincoln at that convention.
Correct. He was. And he helped to get the troops out for Lincoln.
Yeah. Let's go to calls. Let's go to Richard listening to us in Coloma, Michigan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'm just calling about these people that about 100 of people that represent Lincoln around the United States. And I wonder what you thought about some of them that, and, you know, keeping Lincoln alive. And a lot of the schools don't teach much history anymore, and this would help, you know, they would see somebody that looks like or portrays Lincoln, and then we get through to them, and they would learn more about Lincoln and the Civil War time and the reenactments, and they would see how things were in those days.
Well, I think I love some of the Lincoln reenactors. I hope people do get a chance to see them. It's hard to book them right now. They're very busy. I mean, this is the year they've been waiting
right.
for.
Yeah, right.
Ching!
Now, also, obviously, you know, the recent press have really talked about the way in which Barack Obama has been merchandised, one of the most merchandised, you know, presidents of the United States. But, I mean, Lincoln's pretty far up there in his merchandising ability as well.
Right. Lincoln.
He didn't get a piece of the action, though. I don't know whether Obama is or not.
No, he as I said, he published his speeches, made sure everyone saw them. He also was good at creating a visible figure for himself. He didn't have celebrity good looks, but what he did was he sort of exaggerated the features about him that were exotic. He was very, very tall, even by today's standards. So what did he do? He wore the tallest hats he could find and made himself taller. He had this very sort of odd, craggy face. And so what did he do to it? He put a beard on it. He was actually the first president who had a beard. He had a way of cutting a figure, even though it wasn't celebrity good looks.
So he was in 21st century. He was a plotter. He was a schemer. He had strategized. I mean, he clearly was. He was a sort of a young man on the make who was putting a career together shrewdly.
There was even a great story when he served in.
I'm going to let you tell that story because we do have to break. But give us
when he served as a lawmaker to stop a bill he didn't want to advance, he jumped out of the window to break Warren. It's a fact.
Okay, well that's a dedicated politician.
He's a savvy tactician.
1-800-723-8289 tonight on Beyond the Beltway, a special show celebrating the 200th birthday of Abraham Lincoln coming up Thursday. Taking more calls at 1-800-723-8289. We're wide open in the South tonight. If you've got questions in the South, here's your chance. Questions about Abraham Lincoln. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us tonight on this special edition of Beyond the Beltway. Tonight, talking about Abraham Lincoln. And our Democrat tonight is Dan Johnson Weinberger, who I'm sure this is the Republican he will probably say something nice about.
I'm all for him.
Also this evening, he likes dead Republicans. Also with us this evening is Chris Voronis. He is our card-carrying Republican tonight. And also joining us is our special guest, Gary Johnson. He is a noted Lincoln historian, and also he is the president of the Chicago History Museum in Chicago, one of the great museums not only of this city but of the country. And we'll be talking a little bit about some special things that you have coming up on Thursday of this week that's being planned for your institution. But let's go back to calls. Let's go to Carl listening to us in Chicago on WLS. Go ahead. I guess Carl is not there. So let us go to Jay, listening to us in Knoxville on WNOX. Go ahead.
Hi. I was curious if your speakers there could talk about Lincoln and the greenback. I'm not very clear on that. I was wondering if they could educate me on that.
Gary, do you want to tackle that?
Well, you know, it's hard to believe, but as late as the period of the Civil War, currency was issued by different banks around the country, and he was able to unify the currency, which was not just good as a kind of abstract idea. It was good in the sense of finding a way to finance the war. A lot of monetary measures came together with warfare, and that was one of the principles. And of course, there was nothing new about that. The Bank of England had done it for years. For example, so there, it had happened before, but it came together under Lincoln.
Given the passion that he had for the issue of slavery, within the Republican Party, though, there were those that felt that he was somewhat of a moderate. He wasn't pushing it fast enough or far enough, and also there was a lot of criticism of him during Reconstruction as well.
Well, the whole slavery issue really is the touchiest subject with regard to Lincoln, because the true abolitionists were the ones who, for years before the Civil War, had called for the abolition of slavery. And Lincoln had very carefully not joined that group. He had been in contact with them, inspired by them, friends with them, but had not signed up. He was more of what we'd call a gradualist. And so people in his own wing were pushing hard. Quite a few of them refused to support him in 1860.
Although the Emancipation Proclamation was revolutionary.
Right.
But it only applied to the border states.
And to the territories and that they conquered.
So only the territory that he had some control.
Logical. I mean, right. You're not going to free the slaves in Georgia.
It would be a good thing, though. He should have done it. Right? Even though he had no authority to do it, we should have said, every one of you, you're free. You come on over to the Union side, join our army, and defeat this treasonous, rebellious army of Confederates.
Would have been a good symbol.
Was it? Right. Was the Civil War inevitable, given given his at least his political astuteness, knowing that it was an issue that had to be addressed? Because he said that he could not see a nation. He could see a nation that was, you know, all one way or all the other way, but he couldn't see a nation. The House Divided speech.
Right.
Done in Springfield.
Right. I think it was inevitable from that point, from the point of the Kansas-Nebraska Act with popular sovereignty, where the territories would decide themselves what would happen rather than a kind of grand political top-down scheme, from the time of Dred Scott, which raised the question of whether even freed slaves could become full citizens of the United States. It was pretty clear that something had to give. And Lincoln, though, even when he was elected, did everything he can to hold open the possibility that rebellion would not take place. But sure enough, it did.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I like the most about President Lincoln, I have this little quote in my signature file for my email, is that his touchstone in a lot of ways was the will of the people. And he said, why should there not be a patient confidence in the ultimate justice of the people? Is there any better or equal hope in the world? And I really find that inspiring, to think that that's really what, you know, is our ultimate justice, is what the people want. It's not what the smart people want or the authorities want or the experts want, but it's what the people think is the right thing to do. And so that commitment to democracy I find inspiring today.
Did he write his own speeches?
He definitely wrote his own speeches. And in fact, we think of him as a wonderful orator, and he was. But what might surprise you is he did very carefully write them out in advance. Stephen Douglas was more of an extemp speaker and got himself kind of hung up and in trouble when Lincoln was debating him. But Lincoln very carefully scripted what it was that he was going to say. He polished his speeches.
Listening to the broadcast this evening on his way to Springfield, the state capital, is Talbert Chisholm. He is chairman of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Talbert, nice to have you with us on Beyond the Beltway.
Well, thank you, Bruce. I really enjoy your show.
What are some of the activities that you have planned in Springfield as you await the arrival of the President of the United States Thursday?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, one particular event is on Lincoln's 200th birthday celebration at 9:30 in the morning. Fifth grade and eighth grade students all over the state of Illinois will be reading in unison the Gettysburg Address. And so we think that's very, very special. And, of course, it will point out the history and the historic figure of Lincoln and what he means to our country.
For those listening around the country, if you have not been to Springfield and you've not been to the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum, it is a wonderful museum. I know Gary would echo that review. But my question to you, Talbert, is because it's only been open a few years now, why did it take so long for a nation that has revered Abraham Lincoln for so long? Why did it take so long for a presidential museum to open?
I didn't call in to get embarrassed, and that is an embarrassing question.
you've raised a lot of money to keep it going and growing, but I don't mean to put you on the spot, but. It was always curious to me why it took so long for it to happen.
I cannot explain it, and I think it might have had something to do with Springfield being a small Midwestern a town, and for whatever the current, the political currency was never in place here. You know, remember he was born in Kentucky, he youth in Indiana, and his adult life in Illinois. And so for whatever reason, there were things going on in other states, and Illinois did not step up till a few years ago. But now in 2005, we opened the museum. There's been 1,700,000 people through there, including 500,000 children. It is, and you've been there, it's an incredible treasure of this country, of Illinois. And, of course, as you know, last year we purchased the largest collection of Lincoln memorabilia and artifacts and documents in the world that are now on display. Actually, we are rotating them through, but we bought his stovepipe hat, the gloves he had on the night he was assassinated with his blood on them, the clock out of his law office, his presidential seal, his spectacles, his wallet. We have his portfolio. We have the earliest known writing of Lincoln, which he was about 14, you know, from his son book. And that all came from Louise Taper's collection in Los Angeles.
Gary Johnson, what's your answer to the question why it took so long to get it done?
Well, the first presidential library was just Franklin Roosevelt in Hyde Park. So we've had them from that president going forward. So the idea that there would be such a thing as an Abraham Lincoln presidential library and museum, sort of unfinished business. And most of the presidents before Franklin Roosevelt don't have them, but every American needs to visit the library and museum in Springfield. It is an awe-inspiring place.
Dan Johnson Weinberger.
You know, since we're saying nice things about Republicans, I want to continue this this pattern. I think Governor George Ryan, who's right now in prison, I think he deserves a ton of credit for championing the Abraham Lincoln Museum, as does former Congressman, now Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood. These are two Republicans that really pushed hard, as did Majority Whip Dick Durbin. But I think George Ryan doesn't get enough credit for really helping to make this museum happen.
Sure would have been embarrassing if Indiana beat us to the punch.
or Kentucky.
And Senator Durbin will be there on Thursday for the breakfast, and a couple of former governors of Illinois, Thompson and Edgar, will also be there, and also the new governor, Pat Quinn, will be there, and I guess everybody can rejoice that Rod Blagojevich is not going to be there.
Goodness.
He would have been the turd in the punch bowl at the 200th anniversary of the president.
That's why maybe Pat Quinn was onto something. Remember he said
they wanted to move it on.
Smart guy.
I think there is, in fact, that maybe there is something to the speed with which the state senate
they knew it was coming.
Governor Blagojevich.
One other quick thing, because I spent a lot of time in Springfield as a lobbyist. You can take the Amtrak train there, and the Amtrak station is literally one block from the museum. So it's a fantastic way to visit the museum.
Talbert Chisholm, thank you very much. The chairman of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Foundation joining us on his way to Springfield tonight on Beyond the Beltway. Talbert, have a safe trip and have a wonderful celebration come Thursday. I'm Bruce Dumont, 1-800-723-8289. One more segment talking about Abraham Lincoln. When we come back, we'll be talking about the assassination and also his private life. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's go to Birmingham, Alabama, where a longtime listener, Crosby, is listening to us on WAPI. Go ahead, Crosby.
Thank you very much. One quick statement. I think that the assassination of President Lincoln was perhaps the greatest tragedy of this nation. His vice president was from Tennessee. Their policies regarding race relations post-Civil War, I'm sure, would have been different. Has your guest ever speculated on the difference in our history between, let's say, 1865 and 1965 may have been different?
Gary Johnson.
I certainly think it would have been different. His successor, Andrew Johnson, became more or less a prisoner of certain forces in the Senate who were taking a very harsh view of Reconstruction. His successor wasn't able to stand up for anything. Lincoln had already signaled his intentions because one of his last acts was supporting the 13th Amendment, which freed the slaves everywhere. he has signaled in his second inaugural with malice toward none, he would have united the country, having been the war leader, in a way that would have reconciled the Southern whites, but also have brought the African Americans into the political mix as in a way that would stick. I'm confident of that. Of course,
I believe that to be true. Also, he was a great leader.
Right.
Thank you very much. He also went to the Ford Theater that night without his main bodyguard. He was shot watching the play Our American Cousin on April 14th of 1865. He died 9 hours later, actually on the 15th of April, becoming the first president of the United States to ever be assassinated. And there was a 12-day manhunt before they tracked down and shot John Wilkes Booth, an actor who felt that he was doing something for the South, revenge of the South, and again one of the tragic moments in American history. Let's go to Ernie, listening to us in North Smithfield, Rhode Island. Where are you listening? What station are you listening on, Ernie?
The one out of Worcester.
Very good.
Could we have achieved the same ultimate results of the Civil War without all that bloodshed and without effectively destroying our whole federal system, you know, state rights, the 10th Amendment, you know, things that are supposed to be left to the states? I often wonder about that. I wonder if you folks have any, could shed any light on that.
Well, let's get reaction to it because, we should mention in essence that Stephen Douglas, by the way, Stephen Douglas was the person who beat Abraham Lincoln for the Senate. Stephen Douglas was the incumbent senator from Illinois. He beat Abraham Lincoln in 1858, and 2 years later he was one of those running as a Democrat who ran against him, and it was the Stephen Douglas position, basically, that was the states' rights position that let each individual state, make their own decision.
Yes.
But was the Civil War inevitable, and could it have been prevented, in your view?
Well,
based on what you've read,
I mean, what little I know is that when Lincoln takes office, and in South Carolina, the rebellious, treasonous forces decide to take a Union fort. It's hard. I don't know what Lincoln could have done differently when the there's open rebellion happening. So I'm not sure that it's fair to pin the blame on Lincoln, and I'm not sure how you can reconcile slave states and free states.
Well, what little I know, albeit more than Dan, is that I think the path was inevitable in that the institution of slavery was the economic foundation of the South, and they're not going to part with that institution. It's the very way of life, but for war.
Gary Jensen.
Well, slavery, we think of it as essential to the economy in the South in a terrible kind of way. Apart from the labor that the owners, so-called, of the slaves derived, there was a tremendous investment in the value of the slaves. Mm-hmm. They regarded the slaves as property, the mm-hmm. way you'd regard your house or your car. I mean, it's a terrible way of thinking, but the idea that somehow this could be changed from above by an act of Congress or some such thing. It was just unthinkable to the people who had that way of operating.
And when you also look, the caller referenced the tremendous bloodshed of the Civil War. But when you read the stories of the battles, I mean, now in 21st century America, we look at body counts that are coming out of Iraq, and we're startled because it long went over 3,000. I mean, there would be stories of battles where 20,000-30,000 people were killed in one battle.
Right.
And so, how long did it take for that information even to get around the nation? And what sort of resistance was there anywhere to those type of body counts?
Well, there was resistance in certain sectors. New York had draft riots. There was a recent book by the president of Harvard University who talked about the whole question of death in the Civil War. People could not get information about whether their loved ones were dead or alive. They often crossed enemy lines to look for the bodies. I mean, the stories were just terrible.
Gary, we have a minute left. This Thursday, we mentioned what's going on at the Abraham Lincoln Library. But again, for those, probably there's celebrations going on all over the United States. But for those that reside in the city of Chicago, it's only a penny to get into the History Museum
right.
that day.
Yeah, bring your Lincoln penny. You can get into the museum. We will have programs, a celebration, and most importantly, opening a major exhibition on Lincoln, our Lincoln treasures. We have, among other things, his deathbed from the Peterson boarding house in Washington, D.C. Other treasures, we have one of the most significant Lincoln collections. And then down the year, our museum, as well as others, will bring on other exhibitions, other programs. This is going to be a whole year of activity for many museums around the country.
And your website is, quickly?
ChicagoHistory.org.
ChicagoHistory.org. Gary Johnson, the president of the Chicago History Museum, thank you for joining us tonight. Dan Johnson, Weinberger, Chris Veronis, we thank you very much as well. For the special broadcast on Thursday, celebrating the 200th birthday of Abraham Lincoln, I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night.